Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the last installment of Spotlight on Youth for the year. Winter definitely has arrived, and you may hear the wind whipping through the studio. I hope you are all listening to the show from a warm location, or at a minimum, a sufficiently heated one. My name is Lauren Litton, and I am the host of this radio show that is dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The radio show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate in the show by asking questions. To do so, you will dial 347-994-1149. If you want to jot that down, it is 347-994-1149. And you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you will be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. Joining us today is Judy Cox, a consultant for the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Judy is here to provide an overview of the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, or what is more commonly referred to as JDAI. JDAI was developed to safely reduce youth confinement while stimulating broader systemic changes and is the most widely replicated juvenile justice strategy in the United States. Implementing communities have had a wide array of tangible results, including saving taxpayers money. Judy serves as a team leader for the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative occurring in Hawaii and Ohio. Prior to joining the Casey Foundation, Judy was the chief probation officer in Santa Cruz County, California. In 1998, under her leadership, Santa Cruz implemented JDAI as the first replication site in the country and became a model site for the initiative in 2000. To give a snapshot of the type of results Santa Cruz experienced, during a 10-year period, the county was able to reduce its average daily detention population by 53%, reduce admissions to detention by 51%, and reduce the average length of stay by 31%. The effort also had a tremendous impact on reducing the overrepresentation of youth of color, with the Latino detention population decreasing by 59% during the same time period. Judy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lauren. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon.
Well, I'm really excited to have you here today, as you have expertise with JDAI as both a national technical assistance provider and on the ground as a juvenile justice stakeholder. Before we discuss JDAI and all of its facets, I would like you to give our listeners an overview of the issue of juvenile detention and the complications around its use. So perhaps you can start with what we even mean when we refer to juvenile detention.
I think that's a good place to start because traditionally there have been somewhat competing definitions of the word detention. One definition is that of a place, a bricks and mortar building, where young people can be confined by order of the court during the legal process, while they go through court. The second definition is really when we talk about the detention as a process. And under JDAI, we really are trying to meld those two definitions and consider the bricks and mortar place of detention where young people can be held securely as just one of the options the court has available for it while during the pendency of the child's case as they go through court. So in that definition, the place or the building just becomes one part of a continuum that encompasses a range of additional appropriate alternatives that may or may not include a locked, secure facility.
And so maybe you can talk about the use of it. I know when I was practicing in juvenile court, we had kids being sent to juvenile detention to teach them a lesson because there was no foster care placement, and also maybe because they were a flight risk. So what was, like, the original intent of juvenile detention, and how are communities using it today, especially on the pre-trial or pre-adjudicatory side of things?
Well, typically across the nation in every state, there are state statutes that dictate and tell people what the appropriate use of detention can and should be. And in those code sections, we typically see language that tells us that young people can be kept securely in custody to ensure that they make their next court appearance and that they do not reoffend while they go through the court process. However, oftentimes there is language that says that a court can legally hold a young person who is a danger to themselves or others, and or the parent may not be available to provide proper supervision. The problem with that is that there is a wide definition now at play, in that people interpret those elements quite broadly, and we see detention oftentimes used for purposes of making sure that a child is taken care of, that their medical needs are attended to, that their mental health services are handled. And what we've learned in JDAI is that these kinds of services can be provided in a place other than secure detention. And in addition to that, just the location of a detention facility is really not suitable for that kind of care and treatment. So we see sites doing a broad range of things where they'll say there isn't a responsible caregiver. We see courts that will utilize detention for a brief period of punishment or sanctioning because of rule violation. We see sites that think that putting a young person in a secure confinement situation will deter further criminal behavior, and it will modify their behavior in some way. And as I talked about, also for treatment for mental health, substance abuse, even physical health needs. So in the JDAI sites, we are concentrating on making sure that secure detention is used only for those young people that really need to be in secure detention to ensure that they get to their next court appearance and that they do not reoffend while they're going through court. And our experience has been that there really are very few young people that need to be in secure confinement, because the detention alternatives that have been developed to ensure that kids get to court and don't reoffend have been extremely effective.
Okay, so, you know, I know you're jumping right into JDAI, and I just want to make sure our listeners have a little bit of a background on this. And so just maybe one more sort of exploration of detention and its impact on youth and communities, because you're talking about, because there's a lot of communities that aren't using JDAI. So traditionally, communities are and courts are using detention to maybe even get children services and supposed help that they need. But what is the reality of detention? What have we found over the years about its impact?
Well, what we found is that the detention itself is not a benign experience. It really is an experience that can, in fact, create harm for the young person. We know through research that young people who are detained are more likely to penetrate more deeply into the system, to have their case adjudicated, to be ultimately committed to state facilities. We know that they are at risk of negative outcomes such as assaults, sexual assaults, and physical assaults. We know that they this removal from family, from community, and from school has a negative impact. This concentration on providing the bricks and mortar place and trying to provide services for young people in a place of that sort really means that we're not then turning our attention to the place where young people are ultimately going to go back to, and that is their own families, their own communities, and to place meaningful supports and services in those locations. So young people in detention really experience negative life outcomes, and that's why it should be avoided at all costs.
Great. That's great information. And is there something that we know that who generally winds up in detention?
Well, this has been interesting. I think in my experience as I travel across the nation and you talk to probation administrators or detention administrators that are responsible for detention services, they will typically tell you that the people or the young people in detention are the most serious offenders. But in fact, as we look very closely at who is in detention, we realize that there really are a very low percentage, around 20 to 25% of young people who are serious violent offenders in detention. And the rest are there for a variety of things such as low-level drug offenses, probation violations, property offenses that we now know we can provide alternatives in the community as a response to these issues. And these young people, in fact, don't need to be locked up as they go through the court process. So that's always surprising when we ask administrators to set aside what they think is happening in their detention facility and look clearly at the data about who's there. Then I think most significantly, when you walk through detention facilities in the United States, it is really in your face that the kids there are brown and black. These are minority youth who are locked up at a much higher rate than other youth for the same offense, and study after study has shown that that's the case. So there isn't differential offending, but there is differential detention for the same types of offense for young people of color. And this is really a failure of the system to look closely at its policies, its practices, its programs, procedures, to uncover why these disparities exist.
So tell us, for those listening who've never heard of JDAI, what is it and how did it come about?
Well, as you said in your introduction, Lauren, JDAI, we commonly refer to it by those letters. It stands for the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. And in the early 90s, there was a model of sorts put into place or initiated in Broward County in Florida. And in that location, there was an effort to look closely at the young people that were both in detention and then moving forward into state commitments to see if something could be done, alternatives could be put in place to the detention facility. And a number of strategies were put in place there that included pulling together a collaborative of folks who were stakeholders in this process, closely looking at data about who's in detention and why are they there, developing an objective decision-making tool at the front door of detention so that we didn't just have people making their own decision about who should be detained and who should not, but that there was some rational approach to this. And then developing alternatives for those young people who could safely be released into the community, make their court appearances and not reoffend with some supervision. After this was modeled successfully in Florida, the Annie Casey Foundation decided to approach some jurisdictions to model and take this program, or this initiative rather, nationwide, and to try it in other sites. And so as the next group or cohort of sites worked on this, there was significant success noted. And by 1997, two of these model sites had really become models, Cook County and Multnomah County, that's Portland, Oregon, and Chicago. And they were really able to demonstrate that by doing these eight core strategies, some of which I've listed, they were able to really show that kids could be released safely to the community. There could be significant cost savings to in the public policy arena, and certainly public safety outcomes were noted as being very positive. And in 1998, Santa Cruz became the first replication site. And then at this point, we've had more and more sites come onto the initiative. We've got over 100 different sites in nearly 30 state jurisdictions. And this represents over 60% of young people, of youth population in the state. And so it's really a significant reform initiative at this point.
Yeah, I'm sure it's been formalized, and I know that there are, you talked about these eight core strategies, and there's four objectives that I'd like you to review. But I use this in the introduction, and you just talked about replication and model sites. Can you just explain the difference for those listening in?
Well, I think the initial model sites are considered Cook County and Multnomah County, because they were part of the original cohort that was supported through the Casey Foundation and through intensive technical assistance as they implemented these eight core strategies of JDAI. And a replication site really means that after the model sites were able to implement this successfully, everything that came after that is a replication of that initial model. And so when Santa Cruz implemented JDAI, we did not have any funding from the foundation. We were able to implement the eight core strategies through leadership, realigning some programs that we had, changing policies and procedures, and looking for other ways of moving funding around to meet the purpose areas that we felt were important to make sure that we were not overly dependent on unnecessary detention. So now when we talk about replication sites, it's virtually all of the sites that are involved other than those first two model sites in Cook County and Multnomah County. We've also added, when we talk about model sites too, I should also talk about the fact that one of the elements of the technical assistance that's available to sites as they begin to replicate JDAI is a visit from a team of their stakeholders to one of these model sites. And so over the years, in addition to the original sites of Cook County and Multnomah that became models, Santa Cruz as a replication site that ultimately became a model, and that there have been two other sites that have been added to that, and that is Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the state of New Jersey. The state of New Jersey can model for people when you come to visit them. what it's like to implement JDAI beyond just one jurisdiction, but throughout the whole state.
Okay, great. We have some questions coming in, but I think a lot of them actually go to the objectives and getting into the implementation of them. So can you explain, you know, go over what the four basic objectives of JDAI are, and then maybe perhaps we could take each one and discuss it a little bit.
Well, the we have a number. We've thought quite a bit about values of JDAI and our objectives, and I think I'd like to comment that there is a certain gold standard that lies at the base of this as a foundation for everything that we do in JDAI, and that is that that we believe that every juvenile detention and corrections facility in the United States should be run as if only your child, it was your child in the facility, or that your child was the next one to be admitted to the facility. And so if your child had to be detained, you would want the best possible detention facility available. But you would hope, as a parent, that there would be sufficient supports for you and your family in the community so that your child didn't have to experience the negative effects of being locked in a detention facility. So we call that the gold standard, that we want to treat every child as if that child is our own child personally. And the objectives of JDAI are that to eliminate inappropriate or unnecessary use of secure detention. And so by that first one, what we're saying is that for some youth, it may be necessary for them to be in a secure setting while they go through court. But for most youth, that is not the case. We now know that. We've proven that. And if any child is locked in a facility because it is and it is inappropriate in any way or unnecessary, that's certainly a violation of their rights, of their human rights as children. And we as adults want to make sure that we've done absolutely everything we can to eliminate that practice. We want to work to, in addition to that, we want to work to minimize any failures to appear in court and any incidents of delinquent behavior. And in that one, we're talking about our concern about positive public safety outcomes. We certainly don't want young people to commit violations out in the community or to harm others or to victimize others. And so it's very important that the alternatives that are provided to assure that young people get to court as they're supposed to and they do not reoffend during that process.
Judy, if I may, before you go on to the next two, we do have a question that I think is tied to the first two.
Great.
Like that. Okay. So because these first two strategies really are also kind of tied to public safety and who needs to be in detention and who doesn't. So how do you help jurisdictions define public safety based on risk level versus offense and perceptions of dangerousness? Because I'm sure this is one of the issues that jurisdictions really grapple with.
Well, they do. And we ask jurisdictions to engage in a discussion looking at their state law about the proper use of detention and to gather data that tells them who is in detention by offense type so they can look carefully and see how are we using detention locally. And then we ask them to have a discussion about how detention should be used locally and to talk about what are the public safety outcomes and measures that we would like to achieve in our community. And so if a child is going through court and has not been found to have committed an offense yet, is merely charged with an offense, Like in the adult system, children don't have the right to bail, and in many places don't really have pretrial services or pretrial release programs. And so essentially we're trying to meet those goals of making sure that they get to court and that they don't reoffend, and that we're providing sufficient services and supports for those two goals to be met. So in JDAI sites, you will see folks measuring those two outcomes very carefully for kids that are in detention alternative programs. Certainly, we don't want to be running programs if they are not effective. And so holding ourselves accountable as adults is an important part of this. We also have sites beyond just the detention alternative outcomes that I've just talked about. Pick broad public safety goals to measure generally across all of their juvenile referrals. And so typically sites will take measure of things like felony petitions that are filed annually in court, so that they can make sure that their general referral rate to juvenile court is not skyrocketing, or that in fact it's going down. And what we found in JDAI sites is that keeping close track of both the public safety measures on detention alternative programs and the general ones that I've just talked about are a discussion that happens locally with some guidance from the materials and from the experience of other jurisdictions, but they are carefully watched quarterly and then annually to make sure that the community, in fact, is safe.
Thank you. And we do have other questions coming in, but I think they're probably related to some information we're going to get to. So let's, why don't you go over the next two objectives?
So we would also like to be able to redirect public finances to successful reform strategies. So a lot of people will say during these hard economic times, how was this achieved? How is this done? And what you generally see in sites across the nation, and you'll remember that I made reference to Santa Cruz implementing all of the core strategies within a two-year period without any additional funding, but there was some redirecting of finances to alternatives. In some sites, we have seen the avoidance of building new facilities, the closure of wings of a detention facility where there was cost avoidance or cost savings or redirection, and certainly an inventory of the existing programs that exist in the community, and then a realignment or repurposing of them to make sure that they are actually achieving the results that you want, and avoiding any unnecessary confinement or detention. And this has been successfully done across most JDAI sites, where they really have been able to achieve cost savings. And so for policymakers and folks in government, this kind of outcome, along with the positive public safety measures, is both achievable and I think very important and attractive to them. For those kids that do want to be or need to be detained, I'm sure nobody wants to be detained, but we want to make sure that the conditions in secure confinement are the best that they can be. We don't want kids in unsafe situations. And so working on assessing all the elements of secure detention and making sure that these facilities are safe is a key objective of JDAI. And there is actually one more that that has been added over time as we work more deeply in this, and I made reference to it before, and that is we also, as an objective, want to make sure that we're actively working to reduce racial and ethnic and gender disparities throughout the system, because it absolutely is a shameful hallmark of the system that we as adults need to be very intentional about and need to closely look at our practices and our policies to make sure that we're eliminating these inequities and disparities.
I'm just going to remind our listeners that if they want to ask a question live on the air, they should dial 347-994-1149. Just a few questions that perhaps have arisen from what the information you just presented. You were talking about that even in these economic times, the ability to redirect public finances for communities that are either urban or rural, are there differences based on them on what they can do with JDEI and how they would go about implementing that? Because I know for Ohio, and we'll talk about that in a minute, now that it's very exciting that JDEI is coming here, we have, it's a mainly a rural state, although the implementing sites are mostly urban.
Right.
I know, though, that for rural areas, what are some considerations for them and in thinking through alternatives who maybe don't have the same type of resources already existing?
Well, part of it is there are really the 8 core strategies that apply to JDAI apply across the board to whether you're an urban site or whether you are an urban or rural site. So they can do the work in a very rural setting as well as those in an urban setting. This takes some leadership and some joining together at the table by all the stakeholders that are involved in this process. And particularly I want to emphasize, I'm getting a little bit off track here, but I'll come back to your original question. I want to emphasize that the collaborative table that I talk about really needs to include members of the community and family members whose young people have been caught up in the system, because oftentimes they hold the solution to the question or the inquiry that you're asking about, Lauren, and that is through talking instead of providing people in the community or family members or young people with a list of things that you do as a system, often allowing them to be, or inviting them, not just allowing, but inviting them to be leaders in this process, really means that you can get a much more effective solution that's more cost effective and that is really a surprise to those in the formal system. And one example of that is that I can recall a site that was concerned that parents were not coming to court, and they assumed that that was because of a public transportation issue, and they put quite a bit of effort into trying to get bus and train vouchers and covering large distances from a rural area of the county to an urban area to make sure that people got to court. And that solution cost a lot of money, took a lot of public effort to make happen and political effort, and in the end, there really wasn't much of an effect. So folks went back to the drawing table and talked directly to families that were involved in the system, and they heard clearly from families that it wasn't an issue of transportation. It was that they didn't feel as if their voice was necessary in court. They didn't understand the purpose of court. They didn't feel as if they had a role in court, and that's why they weren't coming. So that, of course, then meant a different response from the formal system, that if folks had not been asked what they needed, they never would have heard that answer. And they'd continue to go down an inefficient path of services that really had no meaning and were ineffective. So the rural and urban issue is that we've seen rural sites that have been able to close detention facilities and do regional responses. They have been able to reduce their reliance on any sort of secure detention to the point where they've got a robust system of detention alternatives in the community. And so the fact that they either don't have access to a detention facility or detention beds, or they have to travel vast differences or vast distances, rather, over the terrain, becomes less important. And we do have a number of sites that, in fact, really do have geographic challenges, and they don't have a cluster of services in one particular place. And so looking at the data carefully and understanding what exactly is needed and in what locations, and giving more support to families rather than doing congregate or group programming has been a solution for those sites.
Great. We have less than 9 minutes left with you, and
okay.
So I want to make sure that you talk about what's happening in Ohio, how it came to fruition, and what is the status, and also that you share any other lessons learned from other communities that are implementing, so that those of us who are not formally part of JDAI now can start beginning to think about it.
Well, the Department of Youth Services in Ohio has been interested in getting into supporting JDAI replication throughout Ohio for some time, and they contacted the Annie Casey Foundation and began discussions really several years ago. And at this point, we have the large counties of that are encompassed by the areas in Cleveland, Cuyahoga County, Summit County, Akron, Franklin County, Columbus, Montgomery County, Dayton, and Lucas County, Toledo, have formally begun the process of working on JDAI. And I know that the state of Ohio is certainly eager to replicate statewide, and that's why the central support and administration for JDAI in Ohio will be with the Department of Youth Services. And certainly the lessons learned from each county that joins the initiative will be shared throughout the state, and I think that will be helpful to other counties that are interested in getting involved. Now, the state of Ohio is really a great place to start JDAI, because I think not every state has understood the connection between what happens at the local detention level and local juvenile justice programming level, and what ultimately happens to young people as they move along the continuum and go into a situation of state commitments. So through Reclaim Ohio, I think that the state of Ohio has realized that by resourcing local jurisdictions, they can have a positive impact in reducing the rate of commitment and the usage and the cost with positive public safety outcomes to state facilities. And they realize that through looking at the outcomes nationwide in JDAI, that by concentrating on local detention services and the continuum of services attached to that, that they can continue to have even a broader impact on making sure that young people don't start that trajectory into a state commitment facility. And so that, I think, is of great interest in the state of Ohio. And they've really come a long way down the trail on that, where a lot of states don't understand the connection between local detention services, local juvenile justice services at the county level, and what happens at the state level.
Terrific. Thank you. So I would say we have about 3 minutes left because I promised you that we would only tap into your brain for 45 minutes. And I know we do hope, I want to let our listeners know, to have another show on JDAI where we have a state or community that's been implementing for a while come on and talk about their experience. But maybe briefly, could you say if a community wanted to begin to look at their use of juvenile detention, where would they begin if they were thinking about JDAI? And then any final thoughts you have and what anything else you want the listeners to know about the Casey Foundation. So all those three things in 3 minutes or less.
Okay, well, very quickly. Certainly if you're in Ohio, you can contact the Department of Youth Services. And I recommend that counties get on the Annie Casey Foundation's website and look at the materials there about the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative. As well, there is a help desk, which is JDAI Help Desk, that's one word, .org. And all the materials from all the participating sites throughout the nation are posted there. It's a tremendous resource, and that will tell you a lot about how JDAI works and whether this is something that you'd be interested in your jurisdiction. And certainly begin discussions with all of your local stakeholders, your prosecutor, local law enforcement, probation, detention services, certainly the juvenile court, pulling family members, community, pulling the collaborative together to discuss JDAI and learn about it together is a good place to start. And the you'll learn by visiting the Annie Casey Foundation's website. You can learn about this foundation, which is a private foundation that exists to make sure that they are funding communities and localities to address the nation's most vulnerable, the needs of the nation's most vulnerable children and families. And certainly through JDAI, they've done that. And so I'd encourage people to take a close look at the programs that are there.
Well, Judy, thank you for taking the time to be on today's show, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. The show will be available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/spotlightonyouth. I want to mention two products related to JDAI that were recently developed. There are a fact sheet and brief on juvenile detention reform in Ohio, and these documents can be accessed on the Children's Law Center's website, which is www.childrenslawky.org. That's childrenslawky.org. The next Spotlight on Youth will be in 2011. Until then, wishing all of you a safe and happy holiday season. Thanks again, Judy.
Thank you, Lauren.